all the news that's fit to print. Well, in Российская газета, Russia's rather stodgy newspaper of record. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. Well, welcome to what it turns out is episode 100 of In Moscow Shadows. Now, I suppose really I ought to have therefore done something particularly special, like securing an interview with Gerasimov to talk about his doctrine, or perhaps brought out Surkov to explain quite why Ukraine was never his problem after all. But no. Instead, I do actually, though, want to do something a little bit different. This podcast, like frankly most ones that are Russia-focused these days, is inevitably driven by the big news of the moment, and the big news of the moment is almost invariably directly or indirectly about Ukraine, but it's also our notions of what the big news of the moment is. So what I actually wanted to do instead was take a look at what Russians are being told is the news, and do it very specifically by picking today's issue of Российская газета, which, as I mentioned, is the sort of formal newspaper of record published by the Russian government on today, Sunday the 14th of May, and look at what are the six main stories as shown on its website, because I, for obvious reasons, don't have a paper copy. And anyway, just look through those, see what they say specifically, but also overall, what kind of a message do they give to the Russians about what's happening in Russia and in the world. So that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to start with the lead story, which is a headline, FT, in other words, Financial Times. FT, G7 and EU plan to ban the resumption of Russian gas supplies. Now, this relates to the fact that the G7 gathering of major industrial democracies are going to be gathering in Hiroshima, which, I should add, has already, as you'd imagine, brought the kind of tasteless speculation from the sort of more extreme and less impulse-controlling nationalist commentators on social media that maybe it's time for Hiroshima to get another new king. But anyway, and what they're talking about is in the context of the so-called 11th package of EU sanctions measures, that there'll be further limitations on, as I said, the resumption of gas supplies. So more than anything else, this is a way of trying to lock countries in so that they can't at some point in the future, without wider international agreement, start re-importing Russian gas. Now, I suppose this is a big issue, and certainly it gets top billing. The thing that strikes me, though, is actually how straight down the line it is reported. I mean, interestingly, the three particular news sources that are cited come from RIA Novosti, Russian news agency, fair enough, but also the Financial Times and Bloomberg, two, you know, business-oriented, very fact-based outlets. And the whole article, which isn't especially long, essentially basically lays it out in a way that one could have seen, frankly, in a Western newspaper. Now, I think this is worth stressing because we have a tendency to look at, for obvious reasons, because it's more horrifying or, if we're perfectly honest, more entertaining, the ludicrous, toxic, propagandistic end of the Russian news media. And it's perfectly true that there is a hell of a lot of that. But just as one could look at certain aspects, frankly, of the Western media, you know, particularly at a tabloid level, and would get a totally inaccurate sense of what Western journalism is like if one only sort of looked at them, well, I think it's also worth noting this as a corrective. It's reported very much in the context of Russia being, in this respect, isolated from the G7. But there's no editorialising about why this is evil and Russophobic and toxic. It's there, and it leads the government's own newspaper. There's not really much more to say about that. Let me move on to a rather more emotive and more propagandistic story. And its headline is, quote, "Fixing all the destruction for the future trial of criminals," unquote. How the police work at the site of the Storm Shadow cruise missile attack on LPR Day, Lugansk People's Republic Day. Now, this is very much a reflection of the fact that clearly Russia is deeply alarmed and angered by the fact that Britain has sent long-range Storm Shadow cruise missiles to the Ukrainians, which really does actually provide a substantially enhanced capability, not just because of their range, but also because of the fact that they are able to dodge below radar range. They also have all kinds of countermeasures, so they're hard to identify and shoot down. And they have a two-stage warhead, which means that sort of the first warhead hits and punches in, and then a second warhead punches through. So it can also defeat quite a lot of, you know, heavy bunker defences and the like. So this definitely sort of represents another one of the multiple step changes we've seen in the kind of arsenals available to the Ukrainians, and quite possibly will in due course make it more and more likely that the Americans will also provide the ATACMS long-range missiles that the Ukrainians have wanted, because in some ways the Brits have sort of moved in first. It's a little bit reminiscent, actually, of the way that Challenger tanks, not many admittedly, but nonetheless, by providing Challenger tanks for the Ukrainians, the Brits helped unlock the supply of much, much more numerous Leopard 2s. So this is, I think, one of the roles that the UK has been playing, and I think the Russians are keenly aware of that, which is why they're particularly angry. And anyway, this is a story about the alleged, quite possibly truthful, I don't know, use of Storm Shadow missiles against some targets in what was the old Lugansk People's Republic territory on their National Day. And the claim is that first there was an attack on an industrial site in Lugansk, which left 6 children and teens injured. And then the next day, another one on a former Interior Ministry academy in the village of Yubileni, in which 2 adults were injured. Well, again, maybe that's true. I can't help but feel these don't sound like the kind of high-value targets that you'd want to use your shiny brand-new cruise missiles on. But anyway, that's the story. But the real focus is precisely on the fact that they're now talking about how war crimes investigators, and they have a picture of one in sort of blue helmet and brassard, war crime investigators are looking into this very carefully, making sure they gather all the evidence for some future reckoning. Now, I mean, this is a fairly transparent attempt at pushing back against the much, much more credible and much, much more extensive news about war crimes carried out by the Russians. But the point is, again, it's an attempt to create this moral equivalence. I think that's a really important point. There is some Russian propaganda that is aimed at presenting the Russians as the good guys, the Ukrainians as the bad guys, in purely unrelieved and cartoonish fashion. So, no, Russian soldiers will never attack civilian targets. Just as, after all, Russia has never invaded another country, but only ever defended itself. That's, again, one of the regularly encountered talking points that we find. It's a shame that no one actually then thinks to read any history books. However, there is also a more sophisticated approach, which instead of claiming that Russia is as pure as the driven snow, instead tries to create a situation in which, well, look, the situation's so messy and everyone is basically playing by the same rules that it's impossible really to be sure exactly what's going on and who is to blame. And I think that's what's going on here. So yes, on the one hand, they want to re-emphasize this point about the poor civilians of the Russian-speaking regions of the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, who were, after all, notionally the cause celebre that started this war, and the degree to which they continue to be hammered by the evil Ukrainians, also mentioning the use of HIMARS long-range rockets, but that we are collecting the information and someday we will bring the bad people to justice, but also just generally to create this sense of an escalating NATO involvement in this war. And this was, after all, the central theme of Putin's speech at Victory Day, was the degree to which Russia is actually involved in a struggle with all of NATO, and Ukraine just happens to be the battlefield. And so the provision of British missiles is essentially used as another bit of evidence, quote unquote, to the degree that Ukraine is nothing more than a NATO proxy. But also a final element of this story that I did think was interesting was to look at what links are provided right next to it. And actually the main link is to an article which is headed Daily Mail Readers, Putin will tear Britain apart because of the Storm Shadow missiles for the Ukrainian armed forces. And it purports to be a listing of how Daily Mail readers in the comments section responded and how many of them are saying that it's a stupid and bad decision, that London will be laid waste and that British politicians ought to be tried for treason for getting Britain involved in this. Now, look, I don't question that these comments were left in the comment pages, because this is a tactic that we've seen the Russians using increasingly. Where they're unable directly to sort of broadcast their own perspectives, what they instead do is swarm on social media. And I have to say that it's half entertaining, half deeply dispiriting, looking at the comments on particularly my articles in The Spectator. Spectator is clearly something that the Russian social media generalissimos pay particular attention to, as they should. And we tend to get, I mean, obviously, a fair amount, I'm sure, is genuine, shall we say, counter-mainstream perspectives from within the UK and beyond. But also, there are certain figures who crop up with extraordinary dedication and regularity, very much sort of giving the same pro-Moscow, anti-Western, you know, any time you can bring in, but what about Iraq, or similar messages coming up. And the point is, this is not just simply directly to try and influence Western readers. What happens is this then, as in this case, gets picked up then by Russian state media to try and tell Russians that there is a groundswell of support for their own perspective, or at least in opposition to the West's, amongst the ordinary Western people. So in this case, it's trying to give the idea that your average Daily Mail reader, and I'm honestly not sure these days who the average Daily Mail reader is, what the particular profile is, but anyway, that these people who read what is, let's be honest, a newspaper that I think is fairly characterised by a very nationalist position, and that has been really quite forthright in opposition to Russia's stance on Ukraine. But nonetheless, apparently the readership is up in arms and says that Britain shouldn't be involved in this war, that Ukraine isn't worth supporting, and that any day now terrible things will happen to the UK because of this support. So it's really a way of creating a kind of a feedback loop that allows the Russians to spread more propaganda to their own population. But again, I think it's interesting that it's so important to try and convey the sense to Russians that they are not alone. That in fact, even if the evil hegemonic woke global elites who are framing this whole campaign against Russia are forcing their countries to spend money in supporting Ukraine and its evil Nazi leadership in their genocidal campaign against Russian speakers, but the ordinary people of the West are much more divided, or indeed possibly actively supportive of Russia, I think it says something about a degree, frankly, of insecurity within the regime, that it realises that its stance of trying to kind of North Koreanise Russia and say that we will stand alone and that's our grandeur, it has some traction, but it also actually dismays a lot of people. So this is their way round it. Okay, moving on. What is article number three? Well, article number three is actually the very short one, and it's under the heading of Turkey launches presidential and parliamentary elections. Now, look, it seems fairly clear that from Moscow's point of view, they would quite like Erdogan to win. Not because he's in many ways a Russian ally, but on the other hand, he is someone with whom Putin feels he can do business. He is a known quantity, a known frenemy, to be perfectly honest. And he is also someone who is obstinate, inconvenient, disruptive and divisive within NATO and within wider Western circles. So, look, they clearly would like Erdogan to win, but you would not know it reading this article. Again, it's very short, it's very factual, it just simply reports what's going on. So, you know, again, there's this sort of strange mix of the propagandistic and the proper news stories, which again reminds us that there are actual journalists who are still trying to do journalism, even in Russia. It doesn't mean to say that they can stand against the propaganda, but on the other hand, when presumably they haven't got a metaphorical person sitting on their shoulder telling them what to write, they'll just do journalism. But rest assured, there is indeed good, proper, full-throated propaganda. And we're going to come to that after the break. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/InMoscowShadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. So, continuing my run-through of the six top stories in Rossiyskaya Gazeta, or at least its website, as of the morning of Sunday, the 14th of May, we get what looks like one of the most tedious titles, which is actually in some ways concealing one of the more interesting articles. Well, I should say interesting in terms of what one can read into it, not actually reading it. Anyway, the title is: The Hermitage is returning the shrine of Alexander Nevsky to the Alexander Nevsky Lavra. Mikhail Pietrovsky told RG about the meaning and conditions for the transfer of shrines to the church. Now, at first, I will be honest, there was a part of me that thought, do I really need to read this? Do I really want to read this? Mikhail Pietrovsky, after all, is the Director General of the Hermitage, or technically the State Hermitage Museum, which is the second largest art museum in the world, in St. Petersburg. Not a man I would necessarily describe as a natural wordsmith. And this piece is, by goodness, it's long. But it's actually got some of the most interesting vibes to it, shall we say. It is precisely about the fact that although the Hermitage had control over the Alexander Nevsky Shrine and all the various religious memorabilia surrounding it, this is now finally being transferred to the church at the church's request, but clearly also with the support of the state. And in particular, what he says is this. Here's one particular passage that I think really epitomizes the point that is meant to come across. In today's geopolitical situation, the sacred symbolic meaning of the shrine and the tomb of Alexander Nevsky as the holy protector and patron of the Russian army and Russian diplomacy, one of those is much more in evidence than the other, it's worth noting. That's my little interjection. Anyway, and Russian diplomacy is much more important than their artistic significance. In other words, what Pietrovsky is, frankly, pretty explicitly acknowledging is that at present, the Hermitage's role as one of the great havens, cradles, guarantors in many ways of Russian, not just Russian, but you know, particularly Russian cultural life and historic legacy, must take second place to mobilization for the war effort. And this is the whole point. This is the most recent and particularly interesting manifestation of Putin's mobilization state. It doesn't matter who you are, you will expect to find yourself being required by the state to do your bit for the war effort. And that may be Gazprom funding mercenaries, that may be media outlets forced to run propagandistic stories about why it's great to be in the military, or indeed it may be a gallery expected to offer up, I mean, treasures which, let's be honest, it has held through the Second World War and before. But that doesn't matter, because now there is a current need. And P Gathrovsky is clearly not going to say no. And in this respect, it plays in quite strongly with the fact that at present there seems to be something of a quiet and rolling purge of senior figures who are the guarantors and guardians of Russian culture. There was actually quite an interesting podcast in the Kennan Institute Russia Files series on this back in, I think, April. I will dig out the reference and put a link in the program notes that precisely went through this, the degree to which we are seeing that, you know, even these key cultural gatekeepers are having to demonstrate their own loyalty to the state, regardless of actually what that fits into their own notion of what their job should be. So, lengthy, tedious article you do not have to read, because I have summarised the key point, which is to say that everything, including Russia's history and Russian culture, is now subordinated to the war effort. But a particular, and I thought rather charming irony, was you get, inevitably as this case, pop-up ads that appear when you're sort of moving from one article to the next. And the pop-up ad that came up after that was obviously in Russian, but nonetheless it was advertising elite apartments in Dubai. You know, let's be perfectly honest, we know perfectly well that those people who are most outspoken in their support of the war are probably, if they can afford it, the ones most assiduously lining themselves up convenient sunny bolt holes in places like Dubai. And that was rendered pretty obvious by this juxtaposition of adverts. On we move. This one, which is going to sound like it's even more tedious, but it does have a little point of interest in it. The Ministry of Construction explained why it became easier to build sheds and baths. Baths, I should stress, as in banyas rather than literally tubs. Anyway, this is a short article precisely about how paperwork is being eased and permissions are going to be more simple to acquire for this kind of construction of new outbuildings and the like. And look, in part it's because people want to have even a vaguely positive story to report. In part it is because there has been and there continues to be a technocratic drive to try and make Russia less onerously paperworky a state. And we've seen this for years, and it does in its own small way continue. But I think the most interesting point is that pride of place was given in terms of the fact that it was announced by telegram message from Deputy Prime Minister Marat Husnulin. Now, I've mentioned him in the past as someone who, of late, it's increasingly clear, is worth watching. So let me just dwell briefly on this. And who is Marat Husnulin? Well, as I say, he's the Deputy Prime Minister with particular responsibility for construction and regional development. Previously, he was Deputy Mayor of Moscow between 2010 and 2020. So he is definitely close to Mayor Sobyanin. And in particular, he was responsible for a whole series of what I could almost describe as mega projects or major projects. Things like the expansion of the Moscow's sort of formal boundaries, the revival of the Moscow City Financial Development Center, which basically stalled with the 2008 financial crisis, the construction, or reconstruction rather, of the Luzhniki football stadium for the 2018 FIFA World Cup, and that kind of thing. Very much his is a career which actually has been propelled by the successful moving forward of major projects, which, let us be honest, this is Russia, also means access to and at least partial control over the huge amounts of opportunities for patronage and embezzlement that they offer. Just saying. Because previously, when he was in Tatarstan, he was also very much responsible for the early stages of the construction of the facilities for the 2013 Summer Universiade Games, which again was a big deal, but especially locally. And I remember, I was in Kazan, trying to think back in 2015 or 2016, I can't remember which, you know, and even then, I mean, they were still milking the fact that Tatarstan had been the focus of these global student games. So, you know, this mattered, and he's one of the key figures responsible for, as it was perceived, its successes. So this is a man who basically, you know, has a technocratic orientation. Now, he may or may not happen to get rich in the process, but look, who doesn't in Russia? But the point is that we are now seeing him increasingly involved with Ukraine, or rather occupied Ukraine. There's a massive amount of reconstruction that is planned at the very least. I suppose it very much depends on the success of the Ukrainian summer counteroffensive, how much of it actually goes through. But if it does, first of all, it will mean that actually one of the key axes of the justification for the war, which is that we need to look after our people, quote unquote, which involves reconstruction, will rest on Khusnulin and his success. Secondly, it will mean a lot of money continues to be poured in that direction. A certain amount could indeed stick to Husnulin's fingers or those of his friends. And that also gives you a certain degree of political clout. And thirdly, it means a lot more profile. And certainly, you know, we have seen Husnulin getting a lot more attention, including meetings with Putin of late. So, you know, although this might sound like, well, no, correction, although this is an entirely trivial thing about the permits to build your own shed, in fact, it also speaks to some of the wider transitions in which, you know, a figure like Husnulin, who, let's note, after all, I mean, he is a relative stripling at just 56, so he's definitely part of this new generation of essentially technocratic, opportunistic, sure, but technocratic politicians, who are rising and who at some point are going to replace the septuagenarians. And someone like him, therefore, let's just keep an eye. You know, it may be too obvious to think of a future president as being a Mishustin or a Sobyanin. And maybe it will be hard to think of a Tatar as a Russian president, though people also thought that it was highly unlikely that a Tuvan would become defense minister, and Shoigu has done so for quite some time. So just keep an eye on him. And anyway, finally, if we're talking about people to keep an eye on, the final of the six stories is Alexander Bastrykin called for the introduction of criminal liability for legal entities. I know, another exciting topic. This is the chair of the investigatory committee, Alexander Bastrykin, who is speaking at the St. Petersburg International Legal Forum, though I do have to wonder quite how international it really turned out to be these days. But anyway, there he is. Remember, Bastrykin, for my background, is precisely a lawyer. And he's talking about the fact that legal entities, rather than just human beings, ought to actually have greater scope for being fined or otherwise penalised by the law. Now, this is interesting insofar as it is interesting, for two reasons. One is, look, Bastrykin has been keeping a strikingly low profile of late. And again, I've mentioned this in a previous podcast, that he essentially seems to be trying to bury himself in small-scale local issues, just to show that he's active, without actually having to take any kind of particularly sort of political stance, which might limit his options in the future, when he kind of redefines how he was always, all along, in support of whichever individual, whichever policy actually turns out to win. But the more interesting thing is this particular, what seems to be very, very anodyne interjection, actually fits into the fact that he's currently spearheading a campaign to make himself the key figure in addressing fraud in the defence industrial complex. I mean, his point is, and he makes it in other contexts, that precisely there is a high level of embezzlement and fraud, and that this is crucially undermining the war effort. Now, that is quite important because it's firstly a bit of a power grab. There are other agencies and institutions which could also make a claim that this is their job, but, you know, Bastrykin has identified it, and he is an opportunistic figure who needs to be opportunistic because he doesn't really have many political allies. It suggests that he might have decided to come off the fence, that again he, like frankly I think most within the Russian elite, are accepting that this war is not going to end soon, and that there will be a premium placed on demonstrating loyalty and demonstrating that you have some kind of utility to the war effort. Again, this is him not so much waiting to be mobilised as signing up to try and get the role that he wants. But it's also Bastrykin potentially picking a fight with some powerful key actors. There's been some suggestion of late, very much anecdotal, so treat it with extreme caution, that, for example, Bastrykin has had a falling out with Chemezov. Sergei Chemezov, the chief executive officer of Rostec, which is this big kind of high-tech, but above all military high-tech conglomerate, ex-KGB agent, very close to Putin, we've always felt, though again, some suggestions that there might be a bit of a breach there. But the point is, if Bastrykin is talking about taking on fraud, embezzlement and the like within the defence industrial complex, that will almost invariably mean tangling with Rostec and implicitly suggesting that Rostec's financial management at the very least is subpar, shading into outright claims of direct involvement. So I think, again, the fact that someone like Bastrykin may be beginning to come off the fence, may actually be beginning to do what he does best, which is frankly to be an aggressive Rottweiler, using legal investigations as a tool for his own personal vendettas, but more to the point also to demonstrate his utility to the boss, again says, I think, that we can assume not only that the Russian elite accept that this war is going to be long, but also that those rivalries within the elite, which to a degree were somewhat frozen in the early stages of the war, I think because no one knew what the hell was going on and what the hell was going to happen, and people were just too busy being dismayed as their assets were being frozen and such like. Well, I think actually the almost inevitable political rivalries within the elite are truly beginning to emerge. Bastrykin is not, in my opinion, the sort of person to be, shall I say, an early adopter. I think if he's moving, it's because he realises that generally that's what's happening and that he cannot afford to not be politically active in these increasing subterranean or behind the scenes or under the carpet, however you want to define them, conflicts, or else he will lose territory. I mean, this is a man, as I said, because he doesn't have allies, he has to be constantly demonstrating his value. And so he realises that he needs to act. So even an article by the name, by this title, Alexander Bastrykin called for the introduction of criminal liability for legal entities, is actually him rolling out his tanks and starting a wider process. So that's my run-through of the six top items in Rossiyskaya Gazeta. Firstly, because I did think it said some interesting things about what's going on and the varieties that one can find within, you know, even a relatively sedate media outlet, but one which is, let's be honest, because it's published by the government, one can safely say it is not a maverick outlet. But also in some ways to give you a sense into my own process of, you know, how I try to think when I'm looking at these various items, what I try and work out, you know, may be going on, how I interpret some of this stuff. You may totally and flatly disagree with how I do so, which is entirely your privilege, but at least you have a sense of what I do. Anyway, so that's the end of the 100th episode. I do apologise that we don't have a kind of little closing cameo from Dmitry Medvedev or whatever, telling you how you are all vicious, toxic, Russophobic degenerates for listening to this podcast. I must admit, I would pay good money to have a clip like that. But in the meantime, thank you very much indeed for listening. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.